Ray McGovern was a CIA analyst for 27 years, serving seven U.S. presidents and routinely presenting the morning intelligence briefings in the White House. Angered by what he deems a politicization of intelligence information, he helped found the Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity early in 2003. He was also one of the first members of the intelligence establishment to question the information that was being put out by the White House to justify the war in Iraq. Most recently, he participated in the recent hearings on the Downing Street memo. Welcome, Ray McGovern.
Thanks, Jeff.
In your most recent article, Stay the Crooked Course, following President Bush's Stay the Course speech, you close with a quote from Rudyard Kipling, which is certainly applicable today. It goes, "If they question why they died, tell them because our fathers lied," end quote. He wrote that during the First World War. They're still lying, aren't they?
Yeah, it's very poignant that Kipling should be the author of that, given what a militarist he was. It was because his son died in World War One, in a needless kind of feckless way, and it changed his whole outlook on life. And I think that that's an important point. You have to know someone in the picture, so to speak. You have to be personally involved with some of the victims of war to have a prayer of realizing what war is really like. So back to your question, Jeff. I didn't mean to digress.
Well, they're still lying.
Oh, yeah. It's quite remarkable. People ask me how this is possible, and my first and I suppose my most important answer is simply this, that in 42 years here in Washington, watching what's going on politically, there's been one sea change, and that sea change is, quite frankly, that we no longer, in any real sense of the word, have a free press. We have a domesticated press. We have a corporate-controlled press. We have a press that's very, very close to the government and to the corporations that own it. I'm talking about the media as well, the TV and radio. And so the American people really don't have much chance in hearing what the truth is on these issues and being able to digest it. And that's what our mission in Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity has been, simply to spread a little truth around, but it's an uphill challenge because the major media will have none of it.
We saw the New York Times, which is considered the voice of the liberal establishment, certainly supporting the war from the very beginning and apologizing for it later, but it really hasn't changed that much.
Not at all. It was a positive development that the day after the president's speech last week, the Times expressed horror, shock, that the president would still adduce 9/11 to justify a war against a country that, as the Times pointed out, had absolutely nothing to do with 9/11, end quote. My comment on that was, kudos for the insight. Better 3 years late than never, because as you pointed out, Jeff, the Times was among the leading cheerleaders for the war and deliberately omitted evidence and stories, really, that would have thrown great doubt on the wisdom of attacking Iraq.
You were one of the first from the establishment or former establishment to publicly call the president and his White House cronies a pack of liars. What brought you to that point back in 2003?
Well, I guess what's really interesting here is that I was not the first. As usual, I'm edified by real heroes, and one of those was Ambassador Joseph Wilson. Now, here's the consummate ambassador. Ambassadors, of course, never say the word lie. Here he was exactly 1 year ago, faced with the possibility of telling... I'm sorry, it was 2 years ago, wasn't it?
Yes.
Faced with the possibility of keeping his mouth shut and sitting around in Georgetown cocktail lounges with brandy and cigars and telling war stories as most retired Foreign Services officers are inclined to do, or speaking out and saying, look, I was sent on this mission to Africa. I determined that there was nothing to this story about Iraq seeking uranium in Africa. It's since been determined that the story itself was based on a pack of very crudely done forgeries, and now the president has included it in his State of the Union address. What gives here? And what he permitted himself to say when he wrote his editorial in the Times, it was a 4th of July party that he hosted, the picnic, and there were Washington Post reporters there. And he told them, you know, this begs the question with respect to what else they're lying about. Now, for an ambassador to permit himself to talk about what else they're lying about really necessitates a conviction on the part of that ambassador that these are a pack of lies and that we should finally call a lie a lie. And so I figured, well, you know, if Ambassador Wilson can do that, and the rest of us have seen these lies for many, many years, and people getting killed because of these lies, well, you know, it's sort of a patriotic duty. I mean, it's a matter of conscience to call a spade a spade. And, of course, now we know, given the documentary proof in the Downing Street minutes, that these were a pack of lies. The intelligence was, in the British words, quote, fixed, end quote, around the policy.
No, it's interesting. You wrote an article describing how the apologists for the administration have tried to work around the word fixed to give it a different meaning, as if the word fixed in Britain is different than it is in the United States.
Yeah.
Maybe you could tell us about that.
Well, it was quite amazing. First, there was a think tank person here at the Institute of International Strategic Studies here in Washington that said, no, fixed means something different in the British usage. So I immediately emailed some friends in London and got some very good advice, and also listened to the author of those stories. And the author of the story said, you know, this is a sad joke that they're resorting to that. Fixed means fixed, as in a horse race. And my friends in London all said the same. And one of the newspaper people there said, look, if fixed has a different meaning, we've missed it here in Britain. No one has pointed out any alternate meaning of fixed. So it was a rather desperate move, and it was, as usual, James Woolsey, who was one of the leading neocons. You know, one thing that bothers me about James Woolsey is that he's always introduced as former director of Central Intelligence. Well, he was that. He was the one that couldn't get into the Oval Office. He was the one that when somebody did crash a plane into the White House grounds, the joke around Washington was that that was James Woolsey trying to see the president. So he was that indeed, but lately he has been leading the chorus for the so-called neoconservatives. Now, since I've used that term, I need to say something important to me. I am a conservative, and I object strongly to the use of conservative with a neo or whatever else in front of it to describe this crowd. They are not conservatives in any real sense of the word. They are reckless people, they are radical people, and they have led our country into a whole heap of trouble. So I'll say neocons, but I won't say neoconservatives. In any case, Woolsey was leading the pack, and as you probably know, just a few days after 9/11, he's on, was it Nightline with Dick Koppel? And he says, well, we need to attack Iraq. We have to get Iraq. And Koppel says, well, wait a second. You know, nobody's saying that Iraq had anything to do with what just happened 5 days ago. And Woolsey says, that's all right. Doesn't matter. We have to get Iraq. Well, how transparent can you be? It's right on the record. It's right in the transcript. So here's the cheerleader, and now he's being a little bit embarrassed trying to defend a policy that really has no more defense, since we have the documentary proof that the administration decided on war well before they breathed a word of it to Congress, well before they asked for an intelligence estimate to ex post facto justify this war, and after they had started an air war against Iraq, the dimensions of which have not been disclosed until last month, when Parliament dug out of the Ministry of Defense an account of how many sorties were run against Iraqi targets in the months of June, July, August, September of 2002. And the air war started then. That's when we started pulverizing Iraq, and without so much as a by your leave to Congress or to Parliament.
It seems that I've read more about that in the internet from the European media, from the British media, than I've seen here.
Yeah, surprise, surprise. The dreary situation with respect to the media here was no more apparent than in their handling of the Downing Street minutes. These, for those listeners who are not as involved in all this as I am, these were very important minutes because they recorded the proceedings of a meeting at 10 Downing Street, therefore the name Downing Street Minutes, on 23 July 2002. What was the occasion? The occasion was the head of the British CIA, they call it MI6, Sir Richard Dearlove, had just returned from Washington, where he had talked with his opposite number, then CIA Director George Tenet, and National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, and other senior officials, and he had some startling news. And so they convened this meeting. There were 15 of them there, including the Foreign Minister, the Minister of Defense, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, their equivalent, the Attorney General, all the top folks there, as well as Tony Blair. And Dearlove reported on what he found in Washington. And the key paragraph reads pretty much verbatim like this. The situation with respect to Iraq, war is now considered inevitable. President Bush has decided to remove Saddam Hussein by force. The war will be, quote, justified, end quote, by the conjunction of terrorism and WMD. Now, I probably should translate that sentence. What is this conjunction of terrorism and WMD? Well, it simply means that they were going to say Saddam Hussein has all manner of WMD, weapons of mass destruction, and he's likely to give those things to the kinds of terrorists that just knocked down the Twin Towers, okay? That's the effective rhetoric that would be used. That's the way the war would be, quote, justified, and it's right in the British document. And the last sentence of that paragraph is really astounding. It reads this way, quote, but the intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy, period, end quote. Now, one thing interesting that not many people have looked at is that sentence starts with a but. Now, why do you say, but the intelligence facts are being fixed? Well, it's because the British Foreign Secretary had said, gosh, if you're going to use weapons of mass destruction, you ought to realize that the intelligence on that is very, very thin, his word, thin, okay? And so this is Dearlove's, the head of British intelligence. This is his riposte to that. He says, no problem, but the intelligence and facts are being fixed around the policy. No sweat, we'll fix the intelligence and facts. And that's precisely what they did during the rest of July, August, and September of 2002. They fixed it so well that they persuaded Congress and their Parliament to approve a war that was neither necessary nor justified nor legal, by the way. And so we're off and running, and we're in the quagmire that now exists in Iraq.
Well, it's really interesting, and getting back to James Woolsey, who is on the board of directors of an organization called JINSA, the Jewish Institute for National Security, which is very close, has a number of the same people who are a part of PNAC, the Project for New American Century, who were advocating the overthrow of Saddam Hussein and the change of regime in Iraq during the presidency of Bill Clinton. And it's interesting that the first President Bush and his Secretary of State James Baker and National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft were opposed to the war, claiming it would end up just like it has with the U.S. in a quagmire, and that they had been criticized, the first Bush, because he hadn't taken out Saddam, and this time they were determined to do it. You mentioned Israel, oil, and location of U.S. bases in the hearings. How do you see this playing out in terms of benefiting at least some who thought it benefited Israel, and how easy is it to talk about that subject in Washington?
Well, it's very difficult to use there are two I words that are sort of very dicey. One is impeachment and the other one is Israel. When I was at the congressional hearing, the Conyers panel that took testimony from us back on the 16th of June, I was asked by one of the congressmen there if, he said, I'm confused, if it wasn't weapons of mass destruction and it wasn't ties between Iraq and Al-Qaeda, then why is it that we went into this war? I looked around at my fellow panelists, and none seemed eager to jump in at that point, and so I said something like this. I said, well, I'll try to answer that question because I've been answering that question for about 2 years now in my various lectures to universities and so forth. I use the acronym OIL. O for oil, I for Israel, and L for logistics, because the so-called neocons conceive that it's necessary to have a logistical base in Iraq, permanent military bases, so that we can hold sway in that whole region, so that we can direct the flow of oil and pretty much be in control of what happens when, for example, the House of Fahd falls like a house of cards in Saudi Arabia and so forth. So that's what I use to explain it the best I can. And what I would say, the oil is pretty obvious. The world is running out of oil. And when this coup took office, their main problem was not insurgency, it was not terrorism, it was oil, it was energy. We had blackouts in the West, we had brownouts in the West, we had blackouts in New England and London. Something needed to be done. So historians will look back with some humor in realizing that in the year 2005, people still disputed that oil played a role in the decisions for this war. As far as Israel's concerned, I guess I acknowledge that the last time I mentioned the country Israel in this connection, none other than Wolsey objected and called me anti-Semitic, and that I was really troubled by that because I'm an intelligence analyst here. I'm not a politician, and I don't really trim my sails to what is what can be said in polite conversation. And then I simply cited a couple of comments by General Brent Scowcroft, who was the National Security Advisor to the first President Bush. And what he had said just a few months ago was this. He said that Israeli Prime Minister Sharon has our president mesmerized, is the word he used, and he's got him wrapped around his little finger. Now, when someone as accomplished, someone as experienced and well-regarded, someone who up until just a few months ago was chair of the president's own Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, says that and says that in public, that gives me great pause. It makes me wonder how much influence Israel has on our policy, and how much the people who are crafting our policy, who are the same people that you just mentioned, how much difficulty they have in trying to discern between what they conceive to be the strategic interests of Israel and the strategic interests of the United States. The last part about logistics is self-explanatory. We were at one point building 14 permanent military bases in Iraq. I guess the rhetoric says now it's down to 4, but they're really big ones. And unless and until we disavow any intention of staying in that way in Iraq, the insurgency will continue and will multiply.
In your most recent article, you present some serious and frankly scary criticism of the Bush policy that was made by retired General William Odom. That had to be translated from the German, because it hasn't been published here. Perhaps you could tell the listeners what he said and why you consider it important.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't have it before me, but I have it pretty much committed to memory. The issue was staying the course. Odom was asked on the equivalent of 60 Minutes, the German program Panorama. This was just last September. He was asked, well, what about the staying the course? And Odom said, well, you know, staying the course really doesn't make a lot of sense a wise person knows when to change the course. And he cited Hitler and Stalingrad. He said, you know, Hitler kept sending troops and troops and more troops to Stalingrad, and they got all chewed up by the Russian military machine. That's what got Hitler. That's what he got for staying the course. And then he went on to say, you know, when the president says, let's stay the course, I'm reminded of the fellow who jumps off the top of the Empire State Building, and halfway down he says, well, I'm staying the course. And Odom comments, you know, I'd rather be with some person who can judge when to change course rather than lie splattered on the sidewalk with that person. And he had a final comment there. He said, you know, if we look at the course, if this course was designed to combat terrorism, it has done just the opposite, because before the war, before we invaded Iraq, there were no terrorists to speak of in Iraq. And now we have produced a whole generation of terrorists there. So that's what you get for, quote, staying the course, end quote. Now, I applaud Odom for saying that, and I bemoan the fact that if and when he says such things in the United States, there is no media to pick it up, no media to replay it. Unless you see it, luckily, on some website, you'll be completely ignorant of it.
You know, many people, of course, are comparing our experience with Vietnam, and there are many similarities in terms of the fake intelligence. I remember at the time of the Gulf of Tonkin incident, I told my secretary that the story was a hoax, and she asked me if I thought I knew more than the president did. I said, no, he knows it didn't happen either. How do you compare the Bush administration's doctrine of intelligence with that done during the Vietnam War?
Well, that's a very good question. I was around for those days. I was in the intelligence system, and my responsibilities included Vietnam. The second Gulf of Tonkin incident, in quotes, said to have happened on the 4th of August, 1964, didn't happen. We know that. Admiral Stockdale was one of the planes over above the fleet then, over above those ships, and he saw no flashes of light, nothing. It was a amateur midshipman's or sailor's misinterpretation of some sonar. Okay. Now, we knew that by the next morning, and I have to tell you that I often wondered how a guy like McGeorge Bundy would go up on the hill and deliberately distort the evidence. But he was asked that question by McNeil Lehrer about 10 years ago when McNamara's first book came out. McGeorge Bundy was still around. Now, here was a guy who, I guess he was president of the Ford Foundation, president of Harvard at one point. He's not going to be out on the street looking for a job, you know. And he's sitting in the White House there the morning after, and LBJ comes in. He says, okay, Mac, you going to sell that resolution on the Hill today? And McGeorge Bundy says, I told the president that there was great doubt as to whether anything happened last night. What'd he say? Well, the president said, are you going up the hill to sell that resolution, or are you not, Mac? And what'd you do? I went up and I sold the resolution. Okay. Now that, I outline that because that shows that total power corrupts totally, not only the person who has all the power, but those who are associated with the total power person. And McGeorge Bundy, I'll say again, didn't need the job. He wasn't going to be homeless. They didn't have the moral strength to say, sir, that would be a lie that would lead our country into more difficulty. I won't do it. He didn't have the strength to do that. Now, if you compare that with the Iraqi situation, you really have apples and oranges. Let me explain what I mean. In Vietnam, there was a clear understanding, misguided as it was, but a clear consensus that we were confronting the advance of communism throughout Southeast Asia. We didn't recognize in 1964 that we were getting embroiled in a civil war that we had no business becoming embroiled in. We thought the Soviets and Chinese were coming down there with the help of Ho Chi Minh to take over that whole area, including Indonesia, the so-called domino theory, okay? So misguided as it was an honest mistake, folks, okay? Honest mistake. This thing in Iraq was dishonest from the get-go. We know that the president came into office determined to remove Saddam Hussein, and it's very clear to trace all the circumstantial evidence, as we did for the last 3 years in veteran intelligence professionals for sanity. We no longer have to do that. We have the evidence now in a British document, which Tony Blair, the Prime Minister, acknowledges to be authentic, and which sets out the policy of deceit that this government went by.
Well, they needed a front man to sell this, and that pitch man was none other than Colin Powell. I can't think of anybody else in the administration who could have gone to the UN and gotten away with it. How much responsibility does he have on this?
Well, I feel very badly about this because I know him well. I used to see him every other morning when I was briefing his boss, Secretary Weinberger. He also grew up a mile from me in the Bronx in New York. Powell is the most disappointing phenomenon of all. He knew what the score was. Suffice it to say that he learned very early in life that if he saluted the person right above him, he would advance because he was quite capable, quite bright, and he would advance to the top, which indeed he did in the military structure. And when you get so used to saluting, and you have the commander-in-chief invite you in, as Bush did to Powell in the fall of 2002, and tell you, Colin, we're going to make war on Iraq. We need your support. You're with us, right? I mean, you are with us. Now, I like to think that if I was Secretary of State, I might have said, Mr. President, don't you think we ought to discuss this? I'm your Secretary of State. I would like to be in on such decisions. No, you don't have my support until I have a chance to talk to you about this. Now, something like that was beyond Colin Powell's ken. He saluted, and the next few months were devoted to constructing fixing intelligence and facts to support this war. You know, you wonder what happens to a conscience like that, how someone can be so malleable. And then I think back to McGeorge Bundy. You know, it's total power again. And those who identify or have their persona by virtue of being associated very closely with this total power, it really does corrupt. And it corrupts an otherwise outstanding military person, Colin Powell, and it corrupts him at a time when he, and only he, could have stood up and said, this is crazy, I quit. And that's the only chance we would have had to put a stop to this foolishness.
Bush seems like he's been strapped to the mast as the ship of state heads to the iceberg or develops one leak after another. And Cheney and Rumsfeld seem to have diverging views. Cheney says that resistance is in its death throes. Rumsfeld says the U.S. will have to be there for 12 years. Is there a panic in the Oval Office?
Well, you know, this is not meant to be unkind, but I'm not sure that the president is aware enough to be panicked. He says he doesn't read the newspapers, and I believe him. He says he doesn't read his father's memoirs. Well, that's clear. He never would have gone into Iraq if he had read his father's memoirs. I don't think he talks to his father. Who does he talk to? Where does he get his information
from? He
said
he answers to a higher father when he was asked about that.
Yeah. Well, it's the ones you just laid out. Let me share a little anecdote. I was speaking in Milwaukee, and there was a National Guardsman, Army Engineers, who was just back from Iraq. And so I asked him, oh, what were you doing there? Are we building revetments for aircraft, or what were you building? He said, no, I was building a movie theater. And I said, a movie theater? Oh, you mean like for the indigenous pop? He said, no. I was working at one of these permanent military bases. I was building a movie theater for our troops and their dependents. And he looked at my face and he said, yeah, they're sounding pretty permanent, these bases, aren't they? I said, they are indeed. So there's a little vignette that reflects the reality. But until we give up that notion, we're going to be in this morass, in this quagmire for a long, long time.
is there a way out at this point? The United States, there's been calls for by columnist Tom Friedman and others to double the number of boots on the ground, but there aren't the number of boots to be doubled on the ground. There's talk about reinstituting the draft. The U.S. seems to be in a dilemma in terms of trying to pursue this, the war in Iraq, but being caught up by the fact if there is a draft, you will have an anti-war movement, draft resistance movement that really doesn't exist at the moment.
Sure. Again, a good question. Doubling the boots on the ground. Okay. I think we need to have a historical perspective here. After World War II, General Leclerc, one of the war heroes from France, was sent out to Indochina to find out how many troops it would take to get Indochina back for France. 1945. 3 months later, he reported back it would take over 500,000 troops, and even then, we will not be able to do it. Okay? Fast forward, 1968. United States of America has 536,000 troops in Vietnam, and we were not able to prevail. Fast forward to 2003. General Shinseki, Army Chief of Staff, is asked how many troops it would take to invade and occupy Iraq. He says several hundred thousand. We know that he was talking about 400,000 to 500,000, but he couldn't say those words because they would be too offensive to his civilian masters. He was laughed to scorn. Grossly over-exaggerated, says Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld. And yet, who turns out to be right? General Shinseki. Now, the International Institute for International Affairs in London, others have all come in with this 500,000 figure now. Most of them say also that we still would not prevail. Besides that, reinstituting the draft is politically impossible, I think, for President Bush, for the reason you mentioned, Jeff. It would be an incredible anti-war movement. Why? Because for the first time, folks in Congress, folks that wear ties to work, folks like you and me would be liable, or our kids would be liable, our grandkids would be liable for serving. And that would put a whole different dimension on this. Now, how do we get out? Well, this is the question. Let me just outline two alternatives. One is staying the course, okay? Now, in Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, I am incredibly blessed by the kinds of expertise I used to enjoy at my beck and call when I worked in the Central Intelligence Agency for the same people that people know about Arabs, that people know about insurgencies. There are people who are experts in these fields. So what I'm not sharing with you what bright ideas McGovern has. I'm sharing with you the consensus of what my experts say. And what they say is this. In 2, 4, 6, 12 years from now, there is no guarantee that the situation will be any better in Iraq than it is now. As a matter of fact, almost all of them say it will be considerably worse. There will be even more violence. Okay, that we know. So that alternative, we know what happens if we decide to, quote, stay the course. So what's the other alternative? Are there good alternatives? No, there are no good ones. The president has seen to that. What's the less bad alternative? The less bad alternative is predicated on two premises. One is we acknowledge we don't want permanent military bases in that country. Number two, we acknowledge that we don't have any privilege claim to the oil resources there. Once we do that, then the rest of the world will take us seriously. Then the West Europeans, the Indians, Pakistanis, others will come in, and we can persuade them gently as we withdraw gradually to fill in behind us as necessary, and the UN to come in to help them work out a viable government among the three factions. Now, are we sure that that will work? No, we're not sure that that will work. We are sure what happens with the other alternative, so we have to give it a try. Now, what we have to acknowledge is the uncertainty with that course, the course I just outlined. No one can be sure that it could be accomplished without civil war, without more violence for a shorter period of time. But when you consider the two alternatives, I think it's very persuasive to say, look, there are enough diplomats around. There are enough people with an interest in stability in that part of the world that we can really and truly gather together people who will work hard to make a situation work there. And that, of course, is the course that I would choose.